That string of sensors is monitoring. The computer automatically displays and updates on the CRT the movement of the target along the road. He then can instruct one or a number of the F4s, which I mentioned earlier, to enter into these coordinates, into the aircraft's computer. This gives the aircraft the course to steer to that point and produces an automatic release of ordnance at the proper time to hit the target. Now, this automated battlefield program has been a very top priority item within the Pentagon. It was originally conceived as the McNamara line, or it was derisively called that, which was the idea of setting up a line that would cut off all infiltration from the north. Is this working? Yeah. That would cut off infiltration from North Vietnam. But when that seemed to be failing, the Army response, rather than dropping a program that seemed to be failing, was to instead put more money and pump a larger program into it. The Defense Communications Project Group, which oversees this, is authorized to use the highest industrial priority, according to these hearings, to expedite its development and procurement efforts. This speeds up work by putting us at the head of the lines, this general says, for materials, facilities, and contracting. He says that virtually every U.S. ground unit in South Vietnam is now applying sensors to detect the enemy. Also, training programs have been set up in a central sensor school in Vietnam to train the Vietnamese in using these, who, according to these hearings, have taken over 47% of the use of sensors in ground tactical operations in Vietnam. The U.S. Border Patrol, by the way, in the United States, is also using some of these sensors to patrol the borders of the U.S. You may have read of some recent incidents, like in Mexico, where they were using these to detect possible border crossings with marijuana and things of this sort. And they've also the Justice Department has also put out contracts for surveillance type data of this sort to bring home some of this technology to use on the home front. What they bragged during the hearings was that they'd been able to reduce the normal 5 to 7 year defense development cycle by a factor of 4. That is, the period elapsed from the time that the need was discerned for these sensors until the time that it was placed in the hands of the troops was 15 to 21 months, rather than the usual 5 to 7 years. So it has been, a top priority item within the military. And when the Army outlined its major emphasis, 8 major items for the 70s, automated battlefield components composed most of the list. They have also, by the way, the expenditures on this, according to these hearings, are $1.6 billion, which, if you think about it and compare it to anything else, the poverty program or HUW or anything else, is just phenomenal, much larger than expenditures for federal aid to education or anything else. However, according to columnist Jack Anderson, this figure actually is an underestimate, and you get that feeling clearly from the hearings, too, when they talk about various other parts of it that are funded under other agencies. It probably comes closer to $4 billion that's been spent on developments for the automated battlefield.
You're listening to the Winter Soldier investigation over WBAI in New York City.
Now, the important part of this is not that these sensors are tied into a total system. The automated battlefield concept is not just the concept of sensors, but as comes through in these hearings, it's using these sensors and then tying them in through the data links and through the various data processing equipment to automatically release the weapons that are actually used in Vietnam. And most of the weapons outlined in these hearings are anti-personnel weapons. Many of them are anti-personnel weapons, some of which have been used before in North Vietnam and South Vietnam, but which are constantly being modernized and improved with newer and better versions. You might want to show the slides on that. Can you get the light, someone? This is Ken Kirkpatrick, who's with the American Friends Service with the American Friends Service Committee office in Seattle, who took the pictures that you're about to see. And with him is, well, one of the girls was a napalm victim. You can see her hands bent. So anyway, go ahead with the weapon slides. Here's a Vietnamese holding up what they call the pineapple bomb. A Liao Shin. Yeah, maybe you were with him taking some of these pictures, right?
I'm sorry. I actually took those pictures when
with Ken,
right?
Okay. This
is in a Laotian refugee camp outside of Vientiane. These people had been moved forcibly from the Plain of Jars, their ancestral northern part, by well, I wouldn't say forcibly. They told us frankly they couldn't withstand the bombing, and they agreed to come down near Vientiane in the American held area. And they brought with them this souvenir, which is a pineapple bomb, which did not go off. And these people had fashioned a little wax wick lamp out of this. They're very innovative, I think. They put it to positive use.
Right, next slide. I can just say while he's putting the next slide on that last one, that the last one has little fragments embedded in the side, which but then when it explodes, spew out in all directions, tearing into people's flesh, and not necessarily... were making a very complex pattern that even if it just struck them like in their arm, the pellets could run up through their body and be almost impossible to remove. Let me go on to these other things. Now, this particular one shown here, what did the Laotians call it?
They called the other one that you saw, the lady holding a pineapple bomb. This is a guava bomb.
This is that one with the springs that shot out, right?
Oh, spider bomb, I guess.
Right. Their term for it was spider bomb. The term that is used in the electronic battlefield hearings is wide area anti-personnel munition, which they abbreviate WAMPUM. And in the pictures in the automated battlefield hearings, they show a large canister that looks like an egg box with all the little wide area personnel munitions falling out. Now, these have a spring in them that shoots out a string in all directions, and then maybe you could tell the details on that, how that's tripped as a mine.
You mean the additional particles that come out and fly out?
It's
a non-proximity type device. It has a chemical timing fuse in it, and these are tripped as the spring goes out, as it passes out of the casing of the bomb. And it can spread destruction, as he says, in a wide area, somewhere as much as 60 yards circular, which is representative of about the size of a rice paddy, and has the possibility of getting 5 or 6 people immediately. If these bombs do not go off immediately, a slight jar will set them off later, so people who have been in an area that's been bombed could conceivably come back into the area working, feeling that they were secure from no air raid, and dislodge one of these or disturb it, and then commit havoc again as a result of it.
Well, in this particular one, the springs shoot out a string that's triggered. This is a mine rather than a bomb.
Right. They go at such a distance.
And if anyone then walks through the area and touches the string or anything, this then immediately explodes. And then, like the guava bomb that looks somewhat similar, it would have pellets and so forth embedded in it that would tear into people's flesh and would be aimed at being specifically an anti-personnel weapon. As the name of it, the military nomenclature is a wide-area anti-personnel munition. It's not aimed at, wouldn't even be effective against sandbags or military installations or anything of that sort, only against unprotected human flesh. This is another picture with it extended. You can see the little string there that sets off the explosive.
That's fine. 8 of them were way off.
Right. And Bert was commenting that that you couldn't, it would be very hard to justify this from the standpoint of, I mean, it couldn't be considered a flak suppressant or anything of that sort, because it's not something that you know, that you would shoot at people below or shooting back at you in the plane. It's a thing, well, I guess they would call an area denial mine, but in any case, it's something that would be set off at some later point, would kill any personnel, any people who happened to be in the area and to cross the strings. Do you want to say something first on these? Well, here's both the pineapple bomb that you saw before and the guava bomb with the little pellets inside of it. Maybe we should point out which is where. Well, can you point to them and then I'll...
The other one is what they're
Vietnamese right. Right, there's a pineapple. Oh, okay. Right, you can see the little pellets in the guava bomb. Many are embedded in the casing, but those are some of the others. The ones in the casing also tear out and tear into people's flesh. Right.
Which also is a thing.
And then over on the other side, you see what the Vietnamese call a cloth mine. Is that what they call it?
Leaf mine.
And others, they call it a cloth mine. Ken Kirkpatrick mentioned to me that sometimes Vietnamese children would see these things on the ground, would think they were toys or something, and would pick them up. Basically, that's also mentioned in these hearings and referred to as a gravel mine. The XM41E1 gravel mine. And according to this, it's a anti-personnel mine system which would have no effect against, it's a purely anti-personnel weapon and here's what it says. The only kill mechanism is blast. Gravel will blow a man's foot off, but it will not blow a hole in a truck tire. So it's not even a weapon aimed at killing necessarily anybody in the area, but rather at causing them maximum amount of suffering, blowing off their leg or something like that. It's purposely not powerful enough to kill people, but rather to maim them for whatever military reasons you could figure out, whether it's to demoralize the population, to tie down other people and aiding these people or whatever. But, of course, the Hague Convention specifically says that it's illegal to employ arms, projectiles, or materials calculated to cause unnecessary suffering, which that is clearly the only purpose of that. It wouldn't put somebody out of commission. It would just cause them unnecessary suffering. Do you want to say something first about these?
It shows again the leaf mine that the Vietnamese call it, and it's a little bit of black powder up there, and then a little plastic with the holes in it, and it's just enough to split the foot. And then that knocks you off balance, and you fall, put your hand out, and splits your hand, and the ground will just be covered with hundreds of these. The people coming in to help you, they get their foot split, and it's almost impossible to detect because there's no metal components in it. And it's only about 2 or 3 inches square. The one on the right is a jumping Betty sort of thing, I guess. They told us that they lobbed, bouncing Betty, I mean, that the 7th Fleet used to put these into the villages, and it doesn't show very well in the picture, but what happens is that they have a canister fired from a naval gunnery gun, and it explodes thousands of these things, and they come down, and they're designed to hit at a specific detonating point, which then sends up another bomblet at about 5 feet height, which then goes off with little pellets and catches you right in the face and chest.
That next round one, you can see the writing is still on it. It says mine APERS, APERS, which is anti-personnel, M14 with fuse, I can't see all that, with fuse into integral. Anyway, it gives the specific information on that. And the next one, the one right next to that looks like a little bat. What was the term that they used in that one?
They called that the bat mine.
The bat mine. Terminology used in the automated battlefield hearings talking about the use of these munitions as a part of this complete system, so of course it's been used, it can be used even without the sensory device and so forth, but in this complete cycle, they talk about it as the dragon tooth mine. The dragon tooth anti-personnel mine system. And Major Anderson in the hearing said, it is purely anti-personnel. If a person steps on it, it could blow his foot off. If a truck rolls over it, wouldn't blow up the tire. It wouldn't puncture the tire. So again, this is another one of the purely anti-personnel weapons. And they show a picture in the hearings of a long sort of tubular thing that drops down from the plane and opens up and lets all of these dragon teeth spin out and fly out over a wide area, and the arming begins as it's dropped. The next, then. Do you want to talk about that?
That's the ones I were looking for, but that's out of place, I guess, but that's a picture we took on our first trip, 20 miles out of Saigon. This is what one B-52 would do to a Manioc fields. That's about, each B-52 has 108 500-pound bombs, 750s. And that's just part of the load from one. Keep in mind, we're now making strikes in Laos with up to 30 in one strike. And that means that I just can't imagine. If you see what one B-52 does, what the daily bombing with those things is doing to the countryside up there.
Here's another.
That's another B-52. I think that's the end of the slides, isn't it?
Is that all? Let's see. There was one other that was shown before. I forgot to comment on, but the BLU-66, which is another one that's used in the CBU-46. That was another one of the that was the round one with the sort of a oval round shaped thing on the top of it. And that again is another one, a bomb that whose primary kill mechanism is fragmentation. And these can be dropped from these BLUs can make up a complete CBU, and they're combined with the SUU, which is what's called colloquially the mother bomb, which is a big, well, can either be a dispenser that stays on the plane or the mother bomb that drops out, which is a big, like a 750-pound bomb case, and then opens up, and all these little bomblets, and sometimes a variety of different types of them are inside, and each of these spread out over a very wide area. And then as soon as they stop spinning, or well, a different type of fuses, some are jungle proximity fuses, some detonate as soon as they touch ground, some detonate above the ground, some wait until people are coming to pick up survivors and then go off. But in any case, spring off with just thousands of tiny pellets that just tear into any flesh in the area, but again, would be useless against another industrialized power, again, are aimed particularly at particular type of warfare in Vietnam, where you're fighting a third world people who don't have the advanced technology that we do. The whole automated battlefield is oriented in that direction. In other words, another advanced industrial nation could like jam the sensors and things of that sort, whereas supposedly, simple people like the Vietnamese couldn't. Though in fact, there have been a number of instances where they have been successful in using very simple methods to knock out this advanced electronic equipment. For instance, Mark Lane mentioned talking with one of the GIs who said that the NLF would put buckets of urine under the people sniffers and that this would totally knock them out or whack their sensing perspective. And there's been other things like this. At the same time, though, there's each of these is looked upon by the military as simply another experiment and another research and development contract for another company to come out with another sensing device or whatever that won't be put off by urine buckets or whatever else. They had the same type of problem when they were dropping the acoustic sensors. That at first when they were dropping these in Cambodia, quote enemy would walk very softly and not in order to not be detected by them. So then they dropped tons of these button bomblets, which were just little bombs that would just make a cracking sound when they were stepped on, that would just alert the sensor in the area. But then these were also detected, so then they had some more manufactured that were disguised as animal dung. And similar problems keeping overcome with, like, the plane, the ones that parachute down and then land in the trees, the microphones for the acousids. Originally were able to be detected by the parachute still staying up there, even though the thing itself was camouflaged. And so then they, according to one source I talked to, they asked International Latex, or Playtex Company, to devise a parachute that would disintegrate as soon as the thing reached impact with the tree. And it apparently has very, very fine wires running all through it, which just instantly disintegrate the parachute when it touches down. And so each of the failures, and there have been a lot of failures in their developing this thing over such a short period of time, have been simply used, as I say again, as an experiment result for them to move on to the next more lethal experiment. I think for many people here, it took many of the GIs who've been talking a long time and a lot of soul searching, perhaps, to be able to come out publicly and talk about the war crimes they've been made to commit. But there are many officers or generals that aren't so shy about their war crimes, and in fact brag publicly about those crimes and even glorify them as saving American lives. Again, in these automated battlefield hearings, General Williamson brags that he was the first commander in Vietnam to use these sensors. And he states that, first of all, he says, for the past 25 years, I've been singing a simple tune. If you have to fight, then fight with bullets, not bodies. I've conducted, and then he goes on to say, I hope I can demonstrate how these sensors have helped us to make the first steps toward the automated battlefield. This is a worthwhile approach toward fighting with bullets instead of bodies. That is, getting the job done with a minimum danger to friendly personnel. He says in the third week of September, talking about when they were first starting these activities in 68, our efforts with sensors finally paid off. At 11 o'clock one night, the monitor at a French fort indicated movement was reported by two of the sensors. It was raining hard, but there was no doubt about the reading. Something more than rain was being registered. Two 175-millimeter guns opened up slightly north of the sensors. Six 105-millimeter howitzers commenced blocking fires just south of the sensors, while two 81-millimeter mortars fired directly in the road junction. He says, when the patrol arrived on the scene, they found literally a carnage. The big 175-millimeter guns had found their target. Then he says, gives another example. He talks about the Nighthawk helicopter, which he says he speaks of to emphasize that the sensors were not working in isolation. This helicopter proved to be a valuable night surveillance tool as well as a deadly weapon. The Nighthawk kit consists of a searchlight having infrared and white searchlight capability, mounted coaxially with a crew-served night observation device. Alongside the light and observation device is a pedestal-mounted minigun, the rapid-firing machine gun. As soon as an unmanned sensor registered, a Nighthawk helicopter was dispatched to the scene. We killed 103 North Vietnamese soldiers during a one-month period using this technique, had no personnel cost to us, not even an injury. Just diverting from that for a minute, I'd like to give an example of what this looks like a little bit from the other side. A Quaker worker in Vietnam who was with the Quang Nai program that AFSC sponsors there wrote back in February 69, and this is covered in Narmick's book, Weapons for Counterinsurgency. She wrote back, several of us went to the roof about 3 a.m. The Americans unleashed the terrifying Puff the Magic Dragon, which is an AC-47 gunship, where there's a whole range of helicopters and aircraft that can be outfitted as gunships. That spills forth 5,000 machine gun bullets per minute. As I watched it circle overhead last night, silhouetted against the low clouds in the light of the flares, flinging indiscriminate bolts of death earthward, I could vividly visualize the scene below. Men, women, children, and animals, caught like rats in a flood. No place to hide. No way to plead their case of innocence to the machine in the sky. No time to prepare for death. The beating the civilians are taking in this war is beyond adequate description. The cold, mechanical, compassionless way that monster circled around and around and around, ruthlessly pursuing an unseen, quote, enemy, unquote, stabbing viciously earthward again and again, probing, searching, killing, maiming all in its path. We have survived, but a lot of Quang Nai people didn't make it, and a lot more who are now clinging to life over at the hospital will not make it until morning. If we could only bring the horrifying scene of human devastation in its true dimensions home to the people who must know what it's like, the ones who are pulling the strings on this deadly puppet show. Man's inhumanity to man has reached its climax in Vietnam, she wrote from Vietnam. Going back to the testimony of Major General Williamson, he says, the best real war story that I have is Firebase Crook. This is the story of where 412 enemy soldiers were eliminated with the loss of one U.S. soldier. He goes into a lot of the technical details of the battle and shows how each of the different type of radars and sensors were able to detect people 220 meters this direction, 800 hours, and so forth. And then He says, let's see, Starlight Scope operators spotted movement around midnight. Radar detected two groups about 40 persons each moving 1,500 meters north of the base at about 2030 hours. And the Nighthawk helicopter detected another group of 40 persons actually in formation along Crook. The Nighthawk immediately dived in on its targets. All of the targets were engaged with artillery and mortar fire and all available Army helicopters and Air Force attack planes. And then he said our search of the battlefield proved just how punishing our efforts had been. And he showed the congressman present there a little chart with a body count of the area. And he says, this diagram indicates where the bodies were found and gives us an idea as to which weapons eliminated the enemy. The 60 west of the river were killed almost exclusively by helicopters. 32 along the wood line were killed by indirect artillery. 20 close in were killed by direct fire from the base. The 43 along the road were killed by the Nighthawk helicopters, and the remainder of over 150 were killed by a combination of U.S. Air Force planes and fire from within the base. In all, on the second night, 323 additional enemy were killed and 10 live prisoners taken. I had to move two bulldozers up just to bury the dead. And then he says that we in the Army are continuing tests at Fort Hood, Texas, and elsewhere. We're making an unusual effort to avoid having American young man stand toe-to-toe, eyeball-to-eyeball, or even rifle-to-rifle against the enemy that may outnumber him on the battlefield. We are trying to fight the enemy with our bullets instead of our bodies, of our young men. Firepower, not manpower. How less painful it is to use firepower to fight him at a distance rather than to expend your manpower as the enemy makes his close-in assault. And it just occurs to me as he talks about as he goes through the story of how we can just slaughter people mechanically without any deaths on our part, that if the Nazis had the courage to brag that blatantly, you might have imagined a Nazi general saying, "My best real war story is Dachau, where we slaughtered 1 million Jews with less than one guard lost on our part." This goes a long way toward reaching my favorite slogan of fighting Jews with gas chambers and not with our bodies. Anyway, I guess my time's up, but this is what sort of the Army's outlining this in this area, with really a technological escalation of the war. As they talk about phasing the war down, they need less manpower, but technologically the war is escalating.
Thank you very much. If you'll have lights, please. All right, how much time do we have left now? We only have 5 minutes for questioning. If you come up, state your name and the organization that you're with, if you're a newspaper people or representing someone else, if you want to ask any questions. Where's the microphone that people are going to ask questions use so that I can recognize people? Do we have such a microphone? Or do we just call on? All right, the lady over there by the lights.
Well, for the automated battlefield, first of all, I think that I can go through a whole long list of them, but to begin with, the generals who are guilty of the war crimes aren't just the generals in the Pentagon, but are the like General Dynamics, which makes the ANSS weed and squealer intrusion detector that changes frequently as a person approaches it, makes the ANPPS portable combat surveillance radar, makes the grasshopper anti-intrusion mine that I mentioned. General Motors has been a manufacturer of the M16 rifle, which isn't tied into the automated battlefield, but again is another weapon which has an anti-personnel effect in that it has, recently there have been reports about the dum-dum effect that the M16 has, and now, of course, they're working on an improved version, the SPU, special purpose individual weapon, which is going to be the M19, and even this is a tiny flechette that has a plastic casing on it that drops off, and that the little needle enters a person and spins around inside and makes a huge hole inside, even though just a needle penetrates on the outside. And if it just hits their arm, it'll kill a person. General Electric makes these gunships we were talking about, the AC-47, the various miniguns and so forth that work on it. Let's see, some of the automated battlefield contractors are Westinghouse Electric, Western Electric, Texas Instruments, Berry Rand, Raytheon, Radio Corporation of America, Radiation Incorporated, Magnavox, Kaiser Industries, IBM, Hughes Aircraft, Honeywell, Hazelton Corporation, General Telephone and Electronics, Sylvania Electric,